Welcome to the Common Sense Spirituality Show, the show that takes the mystery out of spirituality with your host, David Gagan, engineer, science director, scholarly researcher of life's mysteries, and author of The Endless Journey.
Welcome to the Common Sense Spirituality Show. I'm host Dave Gagan, and this is the show where we talk about subjects which are critical to our happiness and spiritual evolution. But all too often, we don't think enough about them. Our goal is to break up complicated topics into small enough bits that we can integrate some aspects into our lifestyle. Please note that all the chat room questions will be answered in the chat room on next week's show, as well as posted on my website, which is davidgagan.com, hopefully within a day or so of the show. When you visit the site, you can ask additional questions, even about other shows. You can also listen to any previous show on iHeartRadio at iHeart.com by searching for either David Gagan or Common Sense Spirituality. We encourage and welcome your questions. Today's show is titled Meditation. Everyone is aware of meditation, and many people have tried it, but all too often to no avail. Today we're going to discuss the benefits of meditation and how we can practice it more effectively. Today's guest is Upasaka Chuladasa, alias Dr. John Gates, the author of Dharma, director of Dharma Treasure Buddhist Sangha in Tucson, Arizona, and author of The Mind Illuminated, a complete meditation guide using Buddhist wisdom and brain science. He is a meditation master with over four decades of experience in the Tibetan and Theravadan Buddhist traditions. Chuladasa was ordained as a Upasaka, which is a dedicated lay practitioner, in 1976 and received ordination in the International Order of Buddhist Ministers in Rosemead, California in December 2009. For many years, Chuladasa taught physiology and neuroscience and worked at the forefront of the new fields of complementary healthcare education, physical medicine, and therapeutic massage. His unique lineage allows Chuladasa to provide his students with a broad and in-depth perspective on the Buddha Dharma. He combines the original teachings of the Buddha with an emerging scientific understanding of the mind to give students a rich and rare opportunity for rapid progress and profound insight. In 1996, Chuladasa retired from academia and moved with his wife Nancy into an old Apache stronghold in the southeastern Arizona wilderness to live a contemplative life and deepen their spiritual practice together. Chuladasa leads retreats on his land in Arizona and across the United States. Welcome to the show, Chuladasa.
Good morning, David.
Good morning. It's great to have you here.
Now, I'm looking forward to our conversation, yes. Great to be here.
Yeah, great. Now, you were born and raised John Yates. You have a doctorate and taught physiology and neuroscience, and then changed your name to Chuladasa. What was so important that made you change your name? What did you find?
Okay. Well, I didn't so much change my name as established a newer and deeper identity for myself. And this happened, as you mentioned in your introduction, in 1976. So for two decades after that, I continued to work in the world as Dr. John Yates. But what brought you, your question was what brought me to do that. When I discovered the power of meditation, Buddhist meditation in particular, and then when I discovered the incredible richness of the teachings of the Buddha, I recognized that I wanted to make a commitment, a really deep commitment. And let me get a little background in this. I've probably been a truth seeker since I was in my teens, My entire life, I've been interested in the mind, and I've also been interested in science. So when I discovered what the Buddha's teaching and what Buddhist meditation had to offer, I was not prepared to give up my career, my life, my family, and everything else like that to enter a monastery. Although I have to admit, the temptation was there. But essentially, I wanted to commit myself fully to this. And so this was an alternative way of doing it that dates back to the time of the Buddha, 2,500 years ago. So I essentially made the same commitment that a monk or nun would make, except that I was going to live that out in the context of a layperson. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. That's very good. Now, I read your book, The Mind Illuminated, and I really liked it. You go back and forth between explaining the meditative process and also explaining the science behind it. And I'm kind of science-oriented anyway. So I really enjoyed it. Do you think understanding the science can help you meditate? I know you can meditate without knowing it, but do you think that helps most people to know the science behind it, or do you look at it as, hey, this is just a plain interesting topic, and let me give you some insight into what's going on?
Well, there's actually several dimensions to the answer to that question. Now, on the one hand, I think there are many people for whom it's extremely helpful to understand what's going on. I think there's a huge number of people who have received the traditional meditation instructions, which are really, they tend to be very simple. Sit down, focus your attention on your breath, and if your attention wanders, bring it back. And I mean, that's not the only instruction. There are many different meditation methods and traditions, but essentially they're entirely prescriptive, and the instructions are pretty simple. But what I have experienced teaching, and then what's become extremely obvious since the publication of my book, is that probably the majority of people drawn to meditation are much more successful when they understand why they're doing what they're doing, why they've been given the particular instructions. And yes, I believe it makes a huge difference for them. At the same time, there are a segment of meditators for whom they're not interested at all. Just tell me what to do and I'll do it. And that's fine. By separating these two just enough so that somebody's only interested in the meditation instructions, they can do that. They can just follow that. But I am addressing one other audience. Amongst my students, I have quite a large number who are in areas of cognitive sciences, neurosciences, artificial intelligence. I've got several students that work at Google, one that works at Apple. And so part of my student base and part of my audience for the book are those people who are primarily interested in consciousness and the science of consciousness and mind and the science of mind. And so my students already know this, but the message I'm trying to get out in the book to all of these other people is that, look, you have people who have been studying the mind from the inside for thousands of years, and you're ignoring what they have to tell you. What they can tell you can inform your research. They can tell you what kinds of experiments to do, and they have all this expensive research equipment, and to a certain extent, they're sort of stumbling around in the dark. They say, well, you know, people manifest this kind of behavior. Let's see if we can find out what part of the brain is responsible for that. But what everyone is really interested in is what makes us what we are as human beings, you know. And so this book has a secondary purpose. This other dimension to it is reaching out to the entire community of people interested in consciousness studies and understanding the mind to tell them that there's another science that's been going on for 2,500 years that they really need to pay attention to.
Yeah, that is very true, and that's great. What kind of reception do you get from your students? Do they, do they start looking at life a little bit differently?
Yes, they start looking at life and extremely differently. I don't want to sound like I'm blowing my horn here, okay? But my students achieve tremendous success in their meditation practice in a relatively short period of time. And the measure of that success is the way it transforms their lives and their relationships with others. And I see this on a large scale. And the objective evidence that I can give you for that is go to Amazon. Last time I looked, there's 100 reviews, mostly 5-star of the book, and see what people say over and over and over again. They say, I've been meditating for X number of years, 5 years, 20 years, whatever, and I've made more progress since I got this book than I ever have before. You'll see that comment repeated in those 100 reviews over and over again. The other thing you'll see repeated over and over again is, this has changed my life. This has transformed my life. So I'm trying to say it works. I don't want to sound like I'm just doing a sales pitch for what I teach or for the book that I'm written. I'm saying that there is something in the form of a public forum which is going to validate what I say.
Right. I have read the book, and I have also read your reviews, and you're absolutely right. It's truly an excellent book. Now to get people thinking about this meditation, a lot of people, you know, meditation is we're asking people, and let's face it, everybody's already runs a very busy life, you know. We're saying, hey, this makes sense. Why should people meditate? Can you explain it? And you gave a number in the book, but why don't you talk a little bit about what are the advantages of meditation?
Okay, there are many. They are progressive, and they develop at certain, at different levels. Now, the first and most obvious one, and this is even people who have never meditated and just heard about it are aware of the fact that meditation has a great reputation for relieving stress, helping people to relax, and helping people to cope with difficult situations. And that is, anybody who takes up meditation, even in a very modest degree, will begin to notice fairly soon that they are more relaxed and they do deal with stress better. It also has health benefits. It lowers blood pressure. It boosts the immune system. I could go on and on. I don't need to list those things, but there are a lot of health benefits. So one reason for somebody to take up meditation would be for those kinds of immediate physical and psychological benefits. But as the meditation begins to work on the person, basically increasing their awareness of themselves, of what they're doing, why they're doing, and whether or not it's what they really want to be doing in every interaction, it starts to transform their relationships with other people. They become less reactive, and they're able to respond rather than reacting out of their condition. And so this kind of change takes place. This goes far beyond our interactions with other people, though. Difficult circumstances happen in our lives. Difficult situations regarding our jobs and our careers, and our relationship. You know, more than half of marriages in this country end in divorce, and even marriages that don't end. There's a lot of difficulty. You have teenage children that get themselves into serious problems. You get a diagnosis of a serious disease like cancer, multiple sclerosis, and things like that. Life is fraught with these kinds of psychologically and emotionally traumatic events. And one of the things that meditation gives you is the ability to deal with these with a certain degree of equanimity to, and this is very empowering, because if you're not in a state of reactivity and overwhelmed by your emotions, you're able to make much clearer decisions. You don't suffer as much because of the things that have happened. In the long term development of meditation, we talk about awakening to a greater reality. And that is a point which the suffering engendered by life events, it pretty much disappears entirely. But that's only for somebody who's very serious about meditation and sticks with it for a number of years. But all of these other benefits are developed along the way. I would say that most people get introduced to meditation because they know somebody else that's done it, or they read a magazine article or hear a radio or television show or something on the internet that catches their interest. And most of the time, what catches their interest is that this is a simple practice that is going to make my life better. And so they'll find somebody in their area who offers meditation classes. If they persist with it, the potential goes so far beyond what originally brings them to it, and this is what they discover for themselves.
Now you've put together in this book, explained a 10-stage process that really is very detailed. And it's really interesting about how you can go through the processes. But you break those up into four sections or subgroupings, if you will. Explain those. So they're kind of like various things that you can say. Okay, I'm working on this. I'm working on this. So you can kind of. You can get intermediate goals if I'm explaining that correctly. Why don't you go through and talk about those four different sections?
Sure. Yes. The 10 stages are divided up into, first of all, the beginner or the novice, a novice meditator. Then, secondly, there is the skilled meditator, and the third. Major step, I call it a milestone, is where is a transition phase which leads into the fourth category, which is the adept meditator. Let's compare the first and the last. The novice meditator is somebody who sits down to practice meditation and shortly thereafter suddenly realizes that for the last 5 or 10 minutes they've been thinking about different things, their mind has been wandering, that they forgot entirely what they sat down to do, they forgot to meditate. And so they bring their attention back to the meditation process, and it's only a short time before they're back to, you know, they've forgotten what they're doing and they're forgetting about it. So that's the novice meditator. The adept meditator is somebody who has completely mastered all of the skills and is now applying those skills to a very thorough investigation of their own mind. They've developed what's called metacognitive introspective awareness, the mind watching the mind. And what they're doing when they're meditating is they're sitting there and they're observing how their own mind works. They're learning at a very deep level the nature of who and what they are. The things that adept meditators experience sound like something out of somebody's fantasy or some science fiction story. I mean, they tend to be almost unbelievable. But that is the power of meditation. That is the power of the world.
You know, is this like they're able to interact with the spiritual world when you get to? Is that what they're doing?
Well, to interact with dimensions of reality beyond what we normally experience is part of what an adept can do, but it is a minor part, and it sounds really fabulous and lots of fun, but it's less important. It's much less important than other things. When I talk about experiences, a person reaches a state of physical pliancy where their body just simply feels like a pleasurable but insubstantial something, you know, that is totally free from pain. They can sit and meditate for 2, 3, 4 hours with no discomfort at all and get up feeling spry and energized. In the process, part of that physical pliancy, as we call it, they tend to their visual field, even with their eyes closed, tends to be filled with a brilliant light that seems to come either from everywhere at once or from their chest or the top of their head. You'll notice how that description is very similar to a lot of religious iconography. But ordinary bodily sensations are not pleasant. Present, there is only pleasure. They're no longer having mental images arising, but they're bathed in this brilliant white light. But at the same time, there's mental. There is what's called mental pliancy, and meditative joy arises. They're in a state of intense, really intense joy and happiness. And this will mature into a state of tranquility and equanimity. And this is where they are doing investigation of their own mind is taking place. And yes, it is at this point that you become very clearly aware that there is so much more to reality than what we ordinarily experience with our senses and with our untrained mind. And some people pursue that. But the most important thing is understanding that you are part of a much greater reality and that you are not a separate self. And this leads to deep insights. So if that's comparing those two stages. So the stages are all about how to get from being a novice meditator who has trouble actually doing the meditation to a skilled meditator who can sit down and for an hour practice, and throughout the stages of a skilled meditator, you refine those stages more, those skills more and more, until your skill level allows you to make the transition, and that is a process in itself, stage 7 of the 10 stages, you make that transition to being an adept meditator. Now you apply those skills totally effortlessly. They come to you easily. You can call upon them at any time in your daily life and in any situation. And then as a skilled meditator, here you've now entered the realms of the mystics, the explorers of the boundaries beyond ordinary consciousness and ordinary experience.
Now, in the book, you say that you need to meditate for 1 to 2 hours a day. Now, that's a lot of time. If somebody is going to do that, and maybe you can't do that right away, maybe it takes a little while. But if you're going to do that, say you've committed to it, you're going to meditate an hour a day. How long would it take you to get through what you think the average person, the novice stage? So you can say, okay, I'm about ready to move into the skilled meditator.
Okay. That's a very good question, David. I'm glad you asked. And let me correct you a little bit on what it was that I actually said, because I was actually answering that question of how long and what are the factors that affect it. Now, when somebody begins to meditate, I would suggest that they start out to try to do 20 minutes every day. And in the beginning, doing it every day is far more important than how long you do it every day. And this gets you started. And, it's very hard to find time in our day. It's hard to find 20 minutes to spare, much less 2 hours.
Right.
But if you can, but the first thing to work on is consistency. Because if you meditate twice a week, very good chances that you're not going to have any noticeable benefits for a very, very long time. And there's a good chance that with your busyness of your life, you're just going to quit. On the other hand, if you meditate 20 minutes every day, you're going to see results. And then you can gradually increase the duration of your meditation. And what I actually suggest is that try to, at the very least, to get to 45 minutes once a day. If somebody can meditate for 45 minutes once a day, they're going to start enjoying the benefits of meditation in such a way that they look forward to their meditations, and they're going to find it more and more easy to extend their meditation periods. They're going to want to meditate more. Meditation is going to become a greater priority, and then they'll get up to the point of being someone who, say, meditates for an hour when they get up in the morning and then meditates for an hour again some other time later on during the day. So they're meditating 2 hours a day. Not because someone said you have to do that, in order to meditate, because you don't. 20 minutes every day is fine too. It's just not going to take you to the same place, and it's going to take longer. But for somebody who is serious about becoming an adept meditator, they will need to get to that place of meditating for at least an hour, if not 2 hours a day, of whenever they have a chance, spending a day when they do more meditation than that. They might meditate for an hour at a time for 3 or 4 times during a day. They will go on meditation retreats of a week or 10 days or however long that their life situation permits them to do. And the real question that I was trying to answer in terms of saying, try to meditate, or it would be ideal for a layperson to be able to meditate for an hour twice a day and to do longer meditations whenever they're able to, is if they do that, they can achieve the level of an adept meditator within a period of anything from a few months to a couple of years. Now, there's other factors that enter into that. We're all different in terms of Some people are better at concentration. Some people are better at maintaining a high level of awareness. So of the skills you're developing in meditation, some people start out with a little more of one or a little more of the other. And that will be reflected in their progress through the stages. So they might zoom through some stages and they might spend a whole lot of time on other stages. But that doesn't really matter. If they do a consistent practice of a couple of hours a day and more whenever they can, it's within, as I say, a few months to a couple or 3 years, they will become an adept meditator.
Okay,
if they have... Yeah.
Yeah.
You can see how life affects that too.
Yeah. Yeah. We're obviously not going to go through all the stages, but at least in any detail. But let's start out. I think the first stage, the first few stages are really good. You can kind of give the listeners a feel for what these early stages are and the type of activities that are in them. The listeners, if they're serious, this is a truly great book. The Illuminated Mind is a great book to get. But let's talk about it. Talk a little bit about stage one.
Yes, let's talk about stage one is really all about establishing a regular practice. It's the biggest obstacle, as I said, is to be able to consistently sit down every day and meditate. And that's what stage one is about. It's also about learning how to meditate. So in stage one, you learn the basic practice, a few little tricks like counting breaths, which can help you stabilize your mind. A four-step transition from going from just being in your normal everyday state of mind to being in the meditative state rather than just sitting down and jumping into it. And it also provides you with a way to prepare your mind for your meditation by just reviewing why it is that you want to meditate and what it is that you expect to get out of it. Thinking about the kinds of distractions that are probably going to come up in your meditation, making a resolve not to let them carry you away. So in stage one, you get your basic toolbox, the things that you can use to help you succeed in meditating successfully on a daily basis. At the same time, although it's laid out in 10 stages, you'll be working on more than one stage at a time. So somebody who is still working on establishing a regular daily practice will also be working on stage two, or possibly even stage three. Because let me explain what those are about. Anybody who's ever tried to meditate, and any of your listeners who haven't tried yet, what they will find when they start to meditate is that if not the first time or two, very soon their typical experience of meditation is going to be what I described earlier, where they sit down to meditate, but they find that they can't keep their attention on the meditation. They forget what they're doing. They end up daydreaming or planning some project or thinking about an argument they had with somebody. So what stage two is about is overcoming mind wandering. If it's okay with you, let me just give you a little picture of what's happening in the mind of the person when they meditate.
Yeah.
You sit down and you try to focus your attention on some particular thing. You try to anchor your attention to something. So in the method I teach, you would try to anchor your attention to the sensations of the breath of the nose. Now, some distraction arises in the background. And a distraction is anything that competes for your attention with what you're supposed to be meditating on. So some distraction, some thought arises in the background, and it's competing for your attention. Now, we call it a subtle distraction because it's in the background. But these will creep up on you until you're actually paying more attention to the distraction than you are to the breath of the nose. And now we call it a gross distraction. As soon as a distraction is getting as much attention as your meditation object or more, then it's now become a gross distraction. Any thought that is has a strong enough appeal to become a gross distraction, if you stay with it for very long, you forget entirely about your meditation object. You forget entirely about keeping your attention on the sensations of the breath. You forget that you're sitting down to meditate, and you get engrossed in that distraction. We call that forgetting. Now, if your mind processes that thought, it might trigger another thought, and that might trigger a different thought. Or when your mind gets tired of the initial distraction, it might find a new distraction. And so we call that mind wandering. So you see there's a sequence here. A subtle distraction arises. You haven't lost the meditation object yet. It becomes a gross distraction. You still haven't lost the meditation object. Then forgetting happens. Now you don't even know what you're doing anymore. You're just lost in thought. And then forgetting leads to mind wandering. So we attack this in the reverse order. First of all, let's get over mind wandering. And stage two is all about getting over mind wandering. You still forget what you're doing from time to time, but it never goes into these long drawn out periods of mind wandering. So now stage three, our emphasis is in overcoming forgetting. And there's specific techniques doing that to help you do that. And once you get to the place where you never really forget what you're doing and you never lose attention to the meditation object, you are now no longer a novice meditator. Now you're a real meditator and you have the skill. You can sit for 45 minutes or even an hour, and if you forget what you're doing, it'll happen no more than once or twice in that period. You can now do something that most meditators in the world can't do. And this is really what got me into teaching this. I had people coming to me and they said, I've been meditating for 5 years, I've been meditating for 20 years, I've been, you know. And I would say, well, tell me about your meditation. And they would tell me about how their meditation was full of mind wandering and forgetting. And I would say, well, it's amazing. This person is so dedicated and so determined that they've kept trying for years, yet they're still stuck at the beginner stage. And this is why I started teaching. I said, here, let me give you a little bit of guidance and let me help you overcome this process. So that's really the first three stages, which are the stages of a beginner, is first of all, getting to where you do this regularly every day. You establish a regular practice. Secondly, overcoming these long periods of mind wander. And then thirdly, overcoming these events where you completely forget what you're doing. And then suddenly wake up to, oh my goodness, you know, I wasn't meditating. I wasn't doing what I intended to do.
Yeah, what I liked was in your, in each one of the sections, and we talk about, some of the early sections here that, you would mention things like the five hindrances, so you try to take each one of these stages down to the point of making people aware of the hindrances and the obstacles that they're going to encounter, so that I think that's got to help, because the more aware you are of where you are in the process and you notice these things, the easier it is, I would think, to address them in your mind and overcome them. And I really enjoyed the way you did that. Things like some of the problems you would, procrastination, mind wandering, and monkey mind. And you'd explain all of these things in the book. It's really very good.
Yeah. So thank you. I appreciate your comments. But yes, it doesn't that make total sense though, David? When you think about anything that you are trying to learn or trying to master, doesn't it make all the difference in the world to know what the problems are that you're going to encounter and to have at your disposal things that you can do to overcome those obstacles? I mean, it's not just meditation. It's true of everything. If you're learning golf, isn't it true that what helps more than anything else? I mean, you could go out and hit balls forever, but to have somebody say, look, this is the problem. You're going to tend to make this mistake, and this is how you correct for it. Isn't it true of everything?
The thing about meditation is there's so many books out there on it. So many people say, well, this is what you do. That, where do you go? How do you find one? And that's what I thought was the beauty of your book, The Mind Illuminated, is here is where you can go. Here is where you have a common sense approach that allows you to break the problem down. And what I liked about it is, I read the whole book, but what you want to focus on is the stage that you're at. You can worry about the other stages when you get to the other stages. You just worry about where you are and what's your problems, and that's an insight that I, in all honesty, have never found anywhere else. And I think the fact that you used to teach neuroscience gave you a huge advantage of being able to do this.
Well, it certainly makes me the kind of person who thinks in those terms. This is where we want to get to. What's standing in the way, and how do we find the solutions? And you will not find another meditation book out there anywhere that does this. And this is one of the very unique things, is that because of my background, and quite frankly, because of the years and years that it took me to master the things that now my students are mastering in months, I had to learn this by myself, and I figured this out. And I would go back and I would read texts that were written thousands of years ago, and once I had figured something out for myself, I could look and say, well, that's what they were talking about. Actually, there was a period in time when people were trying to help people by pointing out these problems, but it's written in archaic languages and have been translated by people that didn't understand it, so it's not available. So, but what I tried to do is I looked. Yeah, you got lost along the way. And so what I've tried to do is look at all of the things that I went through and the things that I learned and try to make that available to other people. And having been teaching I've been teaching hundreds, maybe thousands of students, and monitoring their process. I do meditation interviews with those people who are in enough proximity for me to do that. So I'll sit down and discuss their meditation in detail. And I have learned so much from my students. So I've taken my own experience, I've taken what I've learned from my students, I've taken what's been taught by these meditators of old, and that I've taken my understanding of brain science and cognitive psychology, and I've put that all together, and I said, how can I devise a system that's going to streamline this process so that people don't have to make all the mistakes that I made? And that's what I set out to do, and I'd like to think it worked out pretty well.
Yeah. One of the other things that you talk about in the book is what you call a loving kindness meditation, where you can send comfort and aid to others. And you know, this is clearly a powerful tool if you can learn how to use it. And I would think once you're able to control your mind better, you can send energy through thoughts to people, and I suspect you can help cure them. I suspect you could help cure various aspects of yourself at the same time. Have you run into any of that?
Yes, you're absolutely true. You're absolutely right. What you say is absolutely true. A loving kindness meditation has two kinds of effect. One that's very easy to understand is by practicing regularly, rousing in your own mind these very positive states. You're conditioning your mind in a wonderful way, and I think that's an easy thing for most people to understand. Something that becomes clear to adept meditators, and something that sounds a bit esoteric and maybe is a little harder for some of your listeners to believe, is that we're all connected. We're all connected in ways and to a degree that goes far beyond what most of us realize. Your thoughts, your emotions affect other people, and in many ways. So if you rouse in yourself this very, very powerful emotion of loving kindness, and if you visualize people and send that to them, and you visualize them suddenly stopping in the middle of what they're doing and just being overwhelmed by this feeling of happiness and contentment and being free from any kind of ill will or distress, that actually has an effect on not just the person that you visualize, but it's like you're radiating out a field of loving kindness, and it does affect other people. I know this sounds a bit far out, and you're saying that this guy calls himself a scientist, and now he's talking about somehow you can sit here and you can project this out and it's going to affect all kinds of other people. But this is the truth. This is one of those truths that isn't obvious to us until we do something like deep meditation, is that we are all, our minds are all connected. And for good or for bad, our thoughts affect those around us, and in ways that are not obvious at all. But if you do practices like loving kindness, you know, and something quite similar in the Tibetan tradition called Lojong, if you do these kinds of practices, you'll actually see the effect it has on people around you. And it's having other effects that you can't see. And if you could imagine enough people doing this, we could actually change this world.
Yeah, I believe it. Are the young scientists that are working with you, are they seeing that and taking that? You know, science has fought consciousness, you know, for, you know, hundreds of years. Maybe not thousands of years ago, but we've lost it somewhere along the way, and for hundreds of years. But I have the feeling that there are scientists that more and more of them are coming to recognize what consciousness is, or beginning to recognize what consciousness is. Are you finding a receptive group in the, you know, in the science community, or are these already receptive when they show up with you?
Well, I am finding a lot of receptivity especially amongst the younger people in the sciences, and And I'm connecting up with a lot of people who already have that interest. I'm 71, so what's younger is relative. But I have students who are doing their graduate work in the sciences and in psychology, and who are experiencing these things for themselves, and so they're launching themselves into a career in these disciplines with a knowledge and with a direct experience that that no previous generation of scientists and psychologists have had. And there's also a lot of people in their 30s and 40s who have had these interests for a long time, and I'm fortunate enough to connect up with them, and they're perhaps some of them are already doing research, trying to understand this. They're taking meditators and sticking them in fMRI machines to try to figure out what's happening. And so, in my interaction with them, I'm helping them to understand how meditation can inform their science, and you know, they're eating it up. They're loving it.
Yeah, there's a lot of receptivity. How can people find out about you and what you're doing? What can you tell the listeners?
Well, probably the greatest source of information would be to go to dharmatreasure.org. DharmaTreasure. Dharma Treasure, all one word, .org. That website has some of my writings. It has thousands of hours of recordings of talks that I've given. Unfortunately, they're not cataloged at the moment. It also gives you access to a forum, a discussion forum of students of mine, and they are discussing they're actually serving to augment my own teaching. I'm limited in how many people I can reach at any one time. So my students are answering questions of everyone from rank beginners to people who are actually in the adept stages. So that website.
We have run out of time, and unfortunately. But just for people to know, Chula Dasa is spelled C-U-L-A-D-A-S-A, if you're looking them up. Thank you so much, Chula Dasa. You have been a great guest. I've really enjoyed you being on our show.
Well, thank you, David. It's been my pleasure, and I appreciate the opportunity to get this message out. So thank you.
Take care. Obtaining wisdom is a long process, as no one can bestow it on us. The more we talk and hear each other's ideas, the more we'll be able to mature our own views. Questions and answers from the chat room for today's show and other shows will be posted on my website at davidgagan.com. You can ask other questions directly by going to the contact section of my website, and I'll publish those as well. Also, I cover all these subjects and many more in my book, The Endless Journey. I look forward to sharing our thoughts every Friday morning at 9 a.m. United States Eastern Time here on W4CY.com. You can also find all the old episodes on iHeartRadio at iHeart.com. Truth is indeed stranger than fiction, and it turns out to be an amazingly good news story. We all have a great destiny ahead of us. Let me leave you with one last thought. You are a unique spirit having a life experience. You are far more important in the grander scheme of things than you could possibly realize. Enjoy your life. You've earned it.